my biggest frustration when I was in the foundation world was it was very hard to get extra funding to support your grantees' capacity building, to provide technical support, to provide them support that will make them deliver better, quicker, bigger, was very hard. There was always tension between making sure the dollar goes to the person who needs it or to the institution that's doing the work so they can do a better job. So I told myself, I want to be in a place where I can support these institutions to be better than what they do, to be more impactful, to be better structured, to be better organized, you know, to be better led, and to really be able to achieve their fullest capacity. So I couldn't believe my luck when I found Spring Impact and that there's a home for me. There are people like me who are out there channeling, trailblazing, doing this work.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to maximize their impact, because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Berelovitz, founder of Spring Impact. Earlier this year, I stepped down as CEO of Spring Impact, the organization I founded over a decade ago. We decided to pass the baton to Mohammed Osman, and for those who know him, you'll know we couldn't have hoped for a better person to take over. Today, you'll understand why. Mohammed has dedicated his life to scaling impact, beginning with a solution for the lack of water access in his hometown in Kenya. He helped to scale and eventually hand over Peace Direct, now a global peace-building organization. As the grants director at the Elton John AIDS Foundation, Mohammed also made an enormous contribution to HIV treatment and prevention. In this episode, Mohammed condenses his wisdom from the past two decades scaling solutions. On the show, we also talk about his new role as CEO of Spring Impact and his vision for the organization. Mohammed grew up in Garissa, a small town in the northeast of Kenya.
I grew up in a part of Kenya that is incredibly beautiful and it's famous for a very big river called the River Tana, which is on its way to the sea. It's very dry and has very difficult dry and wet seasons. My parents were working middle-class family. My father worked for the civil service as an auditor and my mother worked for the telecom company as a telecom controller. So we had fairly decent suburban quiet life. In a family of five siblings, I'm the firstborn, so a fairly large family, but also very standard at that time in that region. I went to local schools, I went to local high schools, and the first time I traveled properly was to go to university.
Really? So you hadn't been out the country really beforehand?
Not at all, and not very far from where we grew up. We would go on holidays to the coast, but it was a fairly short trip. So going to the big city to study was a big revolution for me, but also very exciting as a young man from the village.
Mohammed went to Kenya's capital to study economics at the University of Nairobi. After graduating, he returned home to embark upon his lifelong mission to find solutions to social issues.
And the problem that we were solving for has been around for a long time. Other people have tried to solve this problem before, but failed. But I felt like with local knowledge and expertise I had from the university, I could hopefully unlock that barrier. So the problem was there was an incredible amount of drought in the area and communities went in and out of drought depending on the rainfall. But the area where I grew up in has an incredible groundwater resource. And people who tried to solve this problem dug wells that pumped fresh water for farming and for their livestock. But these pumps were never maintained properly. So once they ran out of fuel or they ran out of filters, they were left abandoned. So the solution we created was to put in the pumps, but make the communities own the pump and charge a small fee from the users to be able to sustainably manage the facilities during the times of drought and times of rain. Until today, which is more than 20 years later, these pumps are working.
Wow, incredible.
There's sustainable water for this community, reliable water. They know that if they show up with the animals at this place in the middle of the drought, they will get fresh water.
Fabulous. That's a great legacy. So was that something that gave you a sort of taste for social impact? Was there anything else that sort of inspired you?
No, that really sort of gave me the confidence that if you focus on the right things, and if you're willing to try something new, but being very purposeful about it, you can solve a social problem. And in this instance, people were not, say nobody would pay for the water. The communities had now money, they will never pay, you know, it was the equivalent of 1 shilling, which is less than a penny for the water. But we said, if you promise them that it will be there when they need it, they will invest in it. And also that allowed them to be repeatable. So we had more wells in more places because there was a formula which worked and other people were able to do it. And that was used to build other facilities, you know, like a veterinary facility, farming inputs, other ways of supply where the demand was there, but there was no investment, but there was actually money in the community which can be tapped into by being very purposeful. And the other thing I learned, which is important in impact investment, is to really be grounded with the data on the ground. Mm-hmm. The people know what works. Please consult with them.
Yeah, wonderful. Clearly a very early insight into how to create social change. You then decided at some point that you wanted to study abroad, though. Can you talk a bit about how that happened?
Yes, so I was very proud of what I had achieved in my village and in my community. And a friend of mine had gone to study abroad and he came back and he told me stories about what other communities do in India, what people do elsewhere in Latin America. And I just went, wow, there's a whole world out there that I could tap into. I can go out and really stretch my thoughts and ideas. So I applied to come to London School of Economics, my first trip abroad. I remember how excited I was on the plane overnight to London. I couldn't sleep. Everybody fell asleep. How could you sleep? This is incredible. When I got here, apart from the bad weather and the bad food, I was just terribly excited to be in London.
I won't defend our cuisine, although I think it's got better over the years, hasn't it?
It has, thanks to people like us who have come over with some good ideas.
Mohammed focused his studies on the implementation of programs that can be scaled up. Upon graduation, he was offered a well-paying job in the corporate sector. But after a couple of years, Mohammed realized that his purpose wasn't aligned with the company's mission. He moved to join Peace Direct.
Peace Direct had a very simple idea, which was to make peace building as relevant and accessible as human rights. In the 1950s, if you stood up on the streets of London and you said you are a human rights worker or human rights defender, people ask you, what do you actually do? And the point was to change that. So it makes it clear and easy and accessible to do. And Peace Direct had three agendas of that. One was to ensure that stories of peace builders get told. We had to find peace builders and get them the money that they need to be able to do the peace building they were doing. And the third one was to change how conflict is reported globally. So we sponsored what we called peace reporters instead of conflict reporters in newspapers. Mm-hmm. We created a database of peace builders around the world where we raised money for them and we told their stories. And that was my first taste of scale, because it was a small startup and we were turning over about 250,000 to 300,000 pounds a year. And within 4 years, we were turning over 5 million.
Wow.
And we were working in 3 continents and we scaled up really quickly because it was a good idea that was at the right time and with the right people.
Yeah.
We just really caught on. And I realized that myself and the team that were there before, that this has become bigger than us. The skills required here, the thought required here was way, way, way bigger than what we can provide. So as a leadership team, we slowly replaced ourselves with experts who will be able to take it forward. And now it's one of the thriving peacebuilding organization based in the US, in the UK, in Europe, in Africa, and in Asia.
So Peace Direct sounds like a time you learned a huge amount. And I love that insight of sort of good idea, right time, right people, as I think often we can get very excited about the technical nature of something or how well it's working, but there is something to be said for just right time, right people when it comes to scaling. Is there anything else that you learned in that Peace Direct time that you think has set you up well for the future?
I think the thing I learned from Peace Direct, which really helped me at my work with Elton John, was to really find the best in that field that you're working in, which is the tension between many nonprofits have, which is sort of being fair and transparent and working with as many people as possible, or working with fewer who will generally lift or bend the curve on that issue. And that's what Peace Rex showed me, that we could have worked with the many peace builders, and there are many amazing peace builders out there. But we chose to work with the one towards some traction, who had fresh ideas and who occupied the right spaces for their work. Because then we were able to showcase a successful case study that inspired other people to believe in that movement.
Eventually, Muhammad and his team realized it was time to hand over the organization to people with greater expertise.
We were being invited to meetings where we felt less adequately informed or prepared, or we were not the right people to take it that level.
Yeah.
There were experts in that field. There were also people who spent years and years learning about the intricacies of peace, you know, who understood the policy dynamics and networks.
I see.
And we just felt like we were holding it back if we were the ones trying to move it forward. So we stepped back to bring in experts. We call them experts. Other people call them sort of leaders for the next wave. Especially the biggest challenge we had was we didn't know how to work with governments. And peace building required a lot of government relationship. So we brought people who knew how to work with governments. And that was what unlocked the next level of growth for Peace Direct. And we all left from the CEO, our director from international. We left and brought in the team that could do the work. And we...
Wow.
Yeah.
It's quite an extraordinary story. I mean, as we've been working together for a couple of years now, but so often it is the people that get in the way of being able to scale to the next stage. So it's a pretty unusual story to have a turnaround in a management team like that. Hey, Mission to Scale listeners, I need a favor. If the show has helped you in any way, can you share this episode with a friend or colleague? Maybe it's someone who likes listening to good podcasts in their downtime or on their way to work. All you have to do is copy the link in this episode and send it over with a, hey, you might want to check out Mission to Scale. To keep providing the show, we need to build our audience. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe where you listen to your podcasts. Appreciate you for helping spread the word. And thank you for being part of the Mission to Scale community. Now back to the show. So you left and then I think pretty quickly found your way to the Elton John AIDS Foundation, which is an extraordinary organization with an extraordinary man that everyone knows the music. You have spent a great deal of time with the man himself. What attracted you to the AIDS Foundation?
The AIDS Foundation for me was much more personal. I had left Peace Direct and went back home to Kenya to refresh, re-energize and think about the next steps. And when I was back there, my cousin, who was very close to me, was ill in and out of hospital. And we didn't know what was it that she was suffering from. And they tried everything. They tested for everything they could test for. But towards her last few days, my sister was in medical school, had come home and suggested that we should test her for HIV. And this upset my family very much because they thought that was just not the right thing to do. But she insisted, and they did test her for HIV. And unfortunately, she had the virus, but it was too late for her to get treatment. And I was very, very angry that this hospital, which had all the medication and they had all the care and the knowledge, didn't test her because she didn't fit the profile.
Mm.
And I then took upon myself to ensure that anybody who has this disease has a chance to get to know it. They can then decide what to do about it. They can either get treatment or not, but at least at a basic minimum, they will know what is making them ill. And I wrote to many people who I knew back in London and saying, I am looking to work in this area. And many of them told me, well, you're not a public health person. You're not a publicly trained person. And I said, well, I'm sure I have skills I can transfer to this. It was at the same time that Elton John Foundation was looking for, at that time they called head of grants, someone to help them manage their grant portfolio at a time where they were transforming the foundation. And I remember my interview with my former boss, and she did ask me some difficult HIV-specific questions. And I said, I really don't know anything about that side of the HIV. in a technical way. But what I know is about finding the good people and getting behind them. And that's what we want to do in this foundation. We want to find the right people doing amazing HIV work and really support that work. And that seemed to have worked.
Mohammed was hired to lead the grant-making team.
And we had a very simple purpose, which was just to make sure that anybody who has HIV knows about it. So how can we scale up testing? I know now in COVID, testing is seen as a normalized product. But then it wasn't for HIV. People didn't want to test. Testing was difficult to find. It was expensive. It was cumbersome. It was hard to administer. So how can we get testing to everybody? And that's my mission when I came to Elton John. But also we decided to really look at ourselves. And I remember in my first team meeting, I asked the question, what if we don't exist today as a foundation? What would be lost in this space? And that really forced us to focus on what's our niche? How do we add value in this space where there's so many people doing good work? And that allowed us to have a strategy that was purposeful, intentional, and targeted, which allowed my team and the foundation and our partners to punch way above our weight and to really genuinely have had a dent in the HIV epidemic around the world.
Yeah, so tell us, what sort of dent did you have? Because it's a pretty extraordinary story of starting with, you know, a musician. And I know musicians have historically, some of them have done some pretty good stuff, but it's quite surprising how far the whole thing went.
I know, I think what was important for the founder was that the compassion and the fearlessness to go where nobody has gone. The Elton John Foundation was one of the first foundations to supply and invest in children pediatric HIV care when everybody thought that children cannot be given HIV medication. We gave the first HIV medication for children in Africa, it was in Uganda, when people were still waiting for evidence and data and all that, because we knew that you have to get this medicine to these kids as soon as possible. We helped reduce transmission from mother to child in multiple countries from a highs of 15 to below of 2%. Because what the founder did was use his profile and name to be able to convene, to be able to shed light on an issue that was being stigmatized. He's compassionate, you know, and that allowed us, the team, to really push further than we could have pushed. And one of the big lessons I've learned from Elton John Foundation and what I've applied was that we could only go so far alone because the challenge was much bigger. The investment required was in the billions. And our budget then was in the 20 millions. So there's no way we will be the ones who will be solving the problem. But it will be like, how could we use our 20 million to be the wedge which will unlock the next investment? How could we leverage that? And also, how can we invest in ways that bring other people around who feel safer to invest?
There's some extraordinary stories there. There was one that jumped out at me, which I think you went over quite quickly, which was the reduction of transmission of 15% to 2%. So we're talking about the difference between probably, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of children
millions.
Not growing, millions yeah. of children not growing with HIV.
Yeah.
So it's just, I mean, even without the narrative change and all the other good work you did, I mean, how incredible to get millions of children to have the opportunity to grow up healthy and without that hanging over them.
It was incredible, but also it is, solutions were not born by us. There were people like Mothers to Mothers and Mitch Besser and his team who had a solution. So as a grant maker for us, it was to get behind our solution, to help them scale. There's a lot of sort of good solutions out there for HIV, and our frustration was they were not scaled because nobody knew about them, or if they knew, there was a lot of risk of us. You know, people wanted a lot of evidence before they could scale them. But we were saying, take a punt, you know, try, fail, try again, fail, and then something will emerge. Then get behind that. And that's what Elton John Foundation did really well, was being very flexible, being very sort of adaptable to the solutions that were coming through. The other thing we did, going back to what I learned from Peace Direct, was looking for people who are really good at what they do. So we had a motto in our grant making department, which was like, find the best, fund the best, and optimize them. And it was a hard one because people said, then you are favoring the best. It's not them we are favoring. We're looking for who can solve the problem.
Yeah.
And we're focusing on that end goal.
tell us about the Men's Star Coalition, which I know you're very proud of. What did it do and where did it get to?
So there was a big challenge with HIV for a long time because HIV provision was provided from a hospital setting or medicalized setting. And what we found out quite quickly is that men don't come to hospitals unless they have a serious accident or they have become a father. In between, they don't see any reason why they should go into the hospital. But women tend to come for many reasons. And all HIV care was pegged on a visit to a hospital setting. So we were finding that we were testing a lot of women, putting them on treatment and doing all these interventions, but we're missing the funnel. They're getting infected by men who don't come for care, or they come for care too late. So the challenge is, how do you get men into care? And everybody agreed with us, and you know, we had a lot of meetings here in London and convenings and evidence-based and lobbying. But the system was already set up in such a structured way that it was very hard to bring a new solution in it. And we worked with agencies like IDEO, the ORG, and Dahlberg and others to do human-centered design work and spend a lot of time with young men to understand their psyche. What will they respond to? What are they afraid of? And why they're not taking care? Because we had hypotheses, but it was good to validate them in the field. And what came back was a fairly simple issue. They were afraid of finding out, because if they did find out, it took away their masculinity. So the investment program was, how do we turn this on its head? Mm-hmm. And finding out makes you a stronger man and a better man. In Kenya, we designed a music program, a music video, which is hyper-sexualized, which is very popular. And we create a product called Chukua Selfie, which in Swahili means take a selfie, but it also means take a self-test.
Right.
And we helped design a self-test program. So HIV then used to be tested by someone. You had to go to someone to test you. But there were products out there which you could test yourself at your own home. But they were never scaled, optimized, because there was no demand for them. So we created a whole demand for this product. It's called HIV self-test. Mm-hmm. We repackaged it as a cool, high-end product, from the white pale box to sort of colorful boxes with patterns and images. It was co-packaged with other products like aftershave and kits the men want. And it was sold to men in pharmacies and other facilities they were able to access. And suddenly it went from a medical product to a life care product.
Right.
And we saw huge demand, you know, for men wanting to test because it made them a better man. But we knew that once people knew they had HIV, they will eventually do what's right for them and they will seek care. But it might take a few more tests before they accept the result. But their mindset will be fully changed once they have the information. And that was what MindStar did. We were able to get a commitment of $1.2 billion. And by the time I left, more than 1.5 million men have tested for HIV who have never tested before.
Wow. After working for the Elton John AIDS Foundation for over a decade, Mohammed felt that it was time for him to do something different. He decided to take a year off to travel, but his trip was interrupted by the COVID pandemic.
It forced me to really be thoughtful about what I wanted to do next. It gave me this time to be reflective. And I think I told my friends, lockdown unlocked me. It allowed me to be a little bit more brave about what I want to do. And I knew I didn't want to go back to doing foundation work.
Right.
And I knew that I didn't want to do frontline work.
Yeah.
But I needed to do something that connects those two worlds for me. My biggest frustration when I was in the foundation world, and for many program officers listening to this will appreciate that, was it was very hard to get extra funding to support your grantees' capacity building. Mm-hmm. To provide technical support, to provide them support that will make them deliver better, quicker, bigger, was very hard. There was always tension between making sure the dollar goes to the person who needs it or to the institution that's doing the work so they can do a better job. So I told myself, I want to be in a place where I can support these institutions to be better than what they do, to be more impactful, to be better structured, to be better organized, you know, to be better led, and to really be able to achieve their fullest capacity. For me, it was to level the playing field. If you look at the big companies of this world, they go to where they go to because they had great advice. They were able to access incredible professional advice for them to be able to grow and to do what they do. But nonprofits who are doing amazing work, solving huge social problems, often struggle to get advice. So I wanted to be that champion, that super friend that allows you to punch above your weight, because that's what they need. Nobody questions Uber or about their scale plan because they had all these experts behind them. But a small nonprofit in KwaZulu-Natal that has spent 10,000 rand on consulting is vilified. So like, let's fix that. Let's tip that balance and give them the best opportunity to succeed, because they have the right ideas. They're in the right place. They're great people. Why do we expect them to have all the knowledge on scale over and above everything else? So I could not believe my luck when I found Spring Impact, and that there's a home for me. There are people like me who are out there channeling, striving, you know, trailblazing, doing this work.
So yes, exactly. So enter Spring Impact. We'd had one round of interviews and we hadn't hired anyone, and I was sort of starting to feel like maybe we never would, when a recruiter said, oh, there's this guy, it's a bit of a wild card, but he's a nice chap, maybe you should meet him. So we met, and I think very quickly knew you were the right person for the role. This was a couple of years ago. In March this year, Mohammed stepped up to the role of CEO at Spring Impact. I don't know if you're willing to share, not only with me, but the listeners as well. Transitioning from a founder is not straightforward. I hope I am getting out your way as much as possible. Could you maybe just share, how are you feeling? I think that the moment of founder to first CEO is a challenging one. So very keen to hear your thoughts.
I think everybody will agree it's a huge responsibility, because you're following in footsteps that have been really honed over time. And for me as a new CEO, is to really be thoughtful about, why was this founded? What was it trying to solve? And are we still doing that? And if not, how can we do that? So going back to the basics, going back to the mission, going back to the purpose, and then bringing together what we have learned to a new experience. And I think the issue that we have to manage when you have a founder transitioning out is, how do you take the best from the founder, but also allow yourself to be more creative and to bring a little bit more insights and ideas that might not have come because the founder had made choices in the past to go to where they go to, because they were going from scratch. But now you have been given a fully functioning institution that is willing to actually take a new kind of risks, you know, new challenges.
Fantastic. And I think totally validates there's going to be some good things. And I think what new leadership does is just bring, you know, new ways of thinking. And I'm bracing myself for the moment I hear that you've chopped off one of my beloved projects, but I forgive you in advance.
We will not chop them off. We will just optimize them.
Yeah. Very diplomatic as always. So what's your vision for how you'll be able to help the sector, organizations, collaboratives do more, achieve more, you know, help more people and achieve greater impact?
Absolutely. For me, the most important thing is that we exist for the sector that we serve. We are a nonprofit. We're here because of you. We're here to get behind your ambitious goal. We're here to ensure that whatever you want to achieve is done in a strategic, purposeful way that is most efficient, most effective, to be able to achieve your social purpose. And by achieving your social purpose and mission, it allows us to achieve our purpose and mission. And together we can make the world a better place. Often many partners have great ambition. There's no lack of ambition. And often we can help them raise a lot of resources. But what's challenging is to figure out the best solution to scale and the best pathway. And this takes a lot of time. And when you have a dedicated team that is by your side, that is both a critical friend and an enabling friend, that also leaves behind tools and capabilities for your team, for your leadership to be able to perform at scale, that is what my vision for Spring Impact, for our partners. Because not one person can do it alone, but together we can genuinely bend the curve on whatever issues we're focusing on.
What advice would you give to other leaders in the sector who are looking to really scale their impact?
My advice is you really have to keep your North Star. Scale is a cyclical process. You will have a lot of some exciting times and some challenging times. But if you stay true to what your purpose is, as you go to a different level of scale, I think that's what will help you overcome any obstacle that you're going forward. Don't be afraid to ask for help from others. My biggest lesson that I have learned in working in the social sector for many years and at Spring Impact is that organizations don't scale, people scale. We really have to work with people and meet them at the right time and the right place and really allow ourselves to expand our options and viabilities. The other lessons that I have learned is that scale is a long-term solution. It requires flexibility, it requires thoughtfulness, and it requires a very, very adaptable investment opportunity. And finally, data will help you make the right decisions at the right time in your scaling journey.
I've known Mohammed for a couple of years now and worked closely with him, but I never had the opportunity to really delve into his story before. This conversation left me feeling even more confident of our decision to pass on Spring Impact to him. I hope that you were left as excited as I am about the potential of scaling projects that create a better world. And as a side note, I'll still very much be working in the scaling impact space and be a supporter of Spring Impact and all of our partners. And of course, I'll be continuing the Mission to Scale podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode of Mission to Scale, check out Upstarts, a new podcast series by The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Upstarts focuses on the stories of a diverse range of impact entrepreneurs spanning industries, interests, and influence. The series gets to the heart of the journey of an impact entrepreneur, looking into how they built their companies, what problems they're trying to fix, their impact so far, and their hopes for the future. What can we learn, and then action, from their experience? Thank you to our media partner, Alliance Magazine. If you like to stay connected with the latest news in global philanthropy, Mission to Scale listeners can get 50% off your first subscription by using the code SPRINGIMPACT at checkout. Visit alliancemagazine.org to find out more. That's it for today's episode. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss out on any of our episodes. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you could rate and give us a review. If you love Mission to Scale, I hope you recommend our show to a friend or colleague. Thanks so much for joining us, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter.